to look at the photographs, to keep silent, to listen, to talk softly together. And then they leave, without saying goodbye. And that is how it ought to be everywhere. At least these deaths would have left a small scar on our hearts, so that they should not have died in vain. And I, too, have a few such chance photographs. Look at these, at least. Viktor Petrovich Pokrovsky, shot in Moscow in 1918. Alexander Strohbinder, a student, shot in Petrograd in 1918. Vasily Ivanovich Anishkov, shot in the Lubyanka in 1927. Alexander Andreevich Svechin, a professor of the General Staff, shot in 1935. Mikhail Alexandrovich Reformatsky, an agronomist, shot in Orel in 1938. Yelizaveta Yevgenyevna Anichkova, shot in a camp on the Yenisei in 1942. How does all that happen? What is it like for people to wait there? What do they feel? What do they think about? And what decisions do they come to? And what is it like when they are taken away? And what do they feel in their last moments? And how, actually, do they... Well, do they... The morbid desire to pierce that curtain is natural, even though it is, of course, never going to happen to any of us. And it is natural that those who have survived cannot tell us about the very end, because, after all, they were pardoned. What happens next is something the executioners know about, but the executioners are not about to talk. Take, for instance, that famous Uncle Lyosha in the Kresty prison in Leningrad, who twisted the prisoner's hands behind his back and put handcuffs on him, and then, if the prisoner shouted down the night-time corridor, "Farewell, brothers!" crammed a rolled-up rag into his mouth. Just why should he tell you about it? He is probably still walking around Leningrad, well-dressed. But if you happen to run into him in a beer parlour on the islands or at a soccer game, ask him. However, even the executioner doesn't know about everything right to the very end. While a motor roars its accompaniment, he fires pistol bullets unheard into the back of a head, and he is himself stupidly condemned not to understand what he has done. He doesn't know about the very end. Only those who have been killed know it all to the very end, and that means no one. It's true, however, that the artist, however obliquely and unclearly, nevertheless knows some part of what happens right up to the actual bullet, the actual noose. So we are going to construct, from artists and from those who were pardoned, an approximate picture of the death cell. We know, for example, that they do not sleep at night, but lie there waiting, that they calm down again only in the morning. Narokov, Marchenko, in his novel Imaginary Values, a work much spoiled by the author's self-assigned task of describing everything as though he were Dostoevsky, of tearing at the reader's heartstrings and trying to move him even more than Dostoevsky, nevertheless, in my opinion, described the death cell and the scene of the execution itself very well. One cannot verify it, of course, but somehow one believes it. The interpretations of earlier artists, for example Leonid Andreev, seem today somehow to belong willy-nilly to Krylov's time a century and a half ago, and for that matter, what fantasist could have imagined the death cells of 1937? Of necessity, he would have woven his psychological threads, what it was like to wait, how the condemned man kept listening, and the like. But who could have foreseen and described such unexpected sensations on the part of prisoners condemned to death as, 1. Prisoners awaiting execution suffered from the cold. They had to sleep on the cement floor under the windows, where it was 28 degrees Fahrenheit. Strakovich. You could freeze to death while you were waiting to be shot. 2. They suffered from being in stuffy, overcrowded cells. Into a cell intended for solitary confinement, they would shove 7, never fewer, sometimes 10, 15, even 28 prisoners awaiting execution. Strakovich in Leningrad, 1942. And they remained packed in this way for weeks or even months. What kind of nightmare was your 7 to be hanged? People in these circumstances don't think about execution, and it's not being shot they worry about, but how to move their legs, how to turn over, how to get a gulp of air. In 1937, when up to 40,000 prisoners were being held at one time in the prisons of Ivanovo, the internal prison of the NKVD, number one, number two, and the cells for preliminary detention, although they were just barely designed to hold 3,000 to 4,000, prison number two held a mixture of prisoners under interrogation, prisoners condemned to camp, prisoners sentenced to be executed, prisoners whose death sentences had been commuted, and ordinary thieves, and all of them stood for several days so jammed in against each other in one big cell that it was impossible either to raise or lower an arm, and those who were shoved up against the bunks could easily break their legs on the edges. It was winter, but in order not to be suffocated, the prisoners broke the glass in the windows. It was in this cell that the old Bolshevik Alalyakin, with his snow-white head of hair — he had joined the party in 1898 and had quit the party in 1917 after the April theses — awaited for his death sentence to be carried out. 3. Prisoners sentenced to death also suffered from hunger. They waited such a long time after the death sentence had been imposed that their principal sensation was no longer the fear of being shot, but the pangs of hunger. Where could they get something to eat? In 1941, Alexander Babich spent 75 days in a death cell in the Krasnoyarsk prison. He had already reconciled himself to death and awaited execution as the only possible end to his unsuccessful life. But he began to swell up from starvation. At that point, they commuted his death sentence to 10 years, and that was when he began his camp career. And what was the record stay in a death cell? Who knows? Vsevolod Petrovich Golitsyn, the elder of a death cell, so to speak, spent 140 days in it in 1938. But was that a record? The glory of Russian science, famed geneticist N.I. Vavilov, waited several months for his execution, yes, maybe even a whole year. As a prisoner still under death sentence, he was evacuated to the Saratov prison, where he was kept in a basement cell that had no window. When his death sentence was commuted in the summer of 1942, he was transferred to a general cell, and he could not even walk. Other prisoners carried him to the daily outdoor walk, supporting him under the arms. 4. Prisoners sentenced to death were given no medical attention. Okrimenko was kept in a death cell for a long time in 1938, and he became very ill. Not only did they refuse to put him in the hospital, but the doctor took forever to come to see him. When she finally did come, she didn't go into the cell. Instead, without examining him or even asking him any questions, she handed him some powders through the bars, and fluid began to accumulate in Strakovich's legs, dropsy. He told the jailer about it, and they sent him, believe it or not, a dentist. And when a doctor did enter the picture, was it right for him to cure the prisoner under sentence of death? In other words, to prolong his expectation of death? Or did humanitarianism dictate that the doctor should insist on execution as quickly as possible? Here is another little scene from Strakovich. The doctor entered, and talking with the duty jailer, he pointed a finger at the prisoners awaiting execution. "He's a dead man! He's a dead man! He's a dead man!" He was pointing out to the jailer the victims of malnutrition and insisting that it was wrong to torment people so, that it was time to shoot them. What, in fact, was the reason for holding them so long? Weren't there enough executioners? One must point out that the prison authorities often suggested to and even asked many of the condemned prisoners to sign appeals for commutation. And when prisoners objected strongly and refused, not wanting any more deals, they signed appeals in the prisoners' names. And at the very least it took months for the papers to move through the twists and turns of the machine. A clash between two different institutions was probably involved. The interrogatory and judicial apparatus, as we learn from the members of the military collegium, they were one and the same, anxious to expose nightmarish and appalling cases, could not impose anything less than a deserved penalty on the criminals, death. But as soon as the sentences had been pronounced and entered into the official record of interrogation and trial, the scarecrows, now called condemned men, no longer interested them. And, in actual fact, there hadn't been any sedition involved, nor would the life of the state be affected in any way if these condemned men remained alive. So they were left entirely to the prison administration, and that administration, which was closely associated with Gulag, looked at prisoners from the economic point of view. To them, the important figures were not an increase in the number of executions, but an increase in the manpower sent out to the archipelago. And that is exactly the light in which Sokolov, the chief of the internal prison of the big house in Leningrad, viewed Strakovich, who finally became bored in the death cell and asked for paper and pencil for his scientific work. In a notebook, he first composed, "On the Interaction of a Liquid and a Solid Moving in It," and then, "Calculations for Ballistas, Springs, and Shock Absorbers," and then, "Basis of the Theory of Stability." They had already allotted him an individual scientific cell and fed him better, and questions began to come to him from the Leningrad front. He worked out for them volumetric weapons fire against aircraft. And it all ended with Zhdanov's commuting his death sentence to 15 years. The mail from the mainland was slow, but soon his regular commutation order came from Moscow, and it was more generous than Zhdanov's, merely a tenner. Strakovich has all his prison notebooks even now, and his scientific career outside the bars only began with them. He was destined later on to head up one of the first projects in the USSR for a turbojet engine. And N.P., a mathematician with the rank of assistant professor, was exploited by the interrogator Khrushchev. Yes, yes, that same thief, for his personal ends. Khrushchev was taking correspondent courses, and so he summoned P. from the death cell and gave him problems to solve in the theory of functions of a complex variable for Khrushchev's assignments. And probably they weren't even his either. So what did world literature understand about pre-execution suffering? Finally, we learn from a story of C.H. Blank V. that a death cell can be used as an element in interrogation, as a method of coercing a prisoner. Two prisoners in Krasnoyarsk who had refused to confess were suddenly summoned to a trial, sentenced to the death penalty, and taken to the death cell. C.H. Blank V. said they were subjected to a staged trial, but in a context in which every trial is staged, what word can we use to distinguish this sort of pseudo-trial from the rest? A stage on a stage, or a play within a play, perhaps? They let them get a good swallow of that death-like life, and then they put in stoolies, who were allegedly sentenced to die also, and who suddenly began to repent, having been so stubborn during interrogation, and begged the jailer to tell the interrogator that they were now ready to sign everything. They were given their confessions to sign, and then taken out of the cell during the day. In other words, not to be shot. And what about the genuine prisoners in that cell, who had served as the raw material for the interrogator's game? They no doubt experienced reactions of their own when people in there repented and were pardoned. Well, of course, but those are the producer's costs, so to speak. They say that Konstantin Rokossovsky, the future marshal, was twice taken into the forest at night for a supposed execution. The firing squad leveled its rifles at him, and then they dropped them, and he was taken back to prison. And this was also making use of the supreme measure as an interrogator's trick. But it was all right, nothing happened, and he is alive and healthy, and doesn't even cherish a grudge about it. And almost always a person obediently allows himself to be killed. Why is it that the death penalty has such a hypnotic effect? Those pardoned recall hardly anyone in their cell who offered any resistance. But there were such cases. In the Leningrad Kresty prison in 1932, the prisoners sentenced to execution took the jailer's revolvers away and opened fire. Following this, a different approach was adopted. After peering through the peephole to locate the person they wanted to take, they swarmed into the cell, 5 armed jailers at a time, and rushed to grab their man. There were 8 prisoners under sentence of death in the cell, but every one of them, after all, had sent a position to Kalinin, and everyone expected a commutation, and therefore, you today, me tomorrow. They moved away and looked on indifferently while the condemned man was tied up, while he cried out for help, while they shoved a child's rubber ball into his mouth. Now, looking at that child's ball. Could one really guess all its possible uses? What a good example for a lecturer on the dialectical method. Does hope lend strength, or does it weaken a man? If the condemned men in every cell had ganged up on the executioners as they came in and choked them, wouldn't this have ended the execution sooner than appeals to the all-Russian Central Executive Committee? When one is already on the edge of the grave, why not resist? But wasn't everything foredoomed anyway from the moment of arrest? Yet all the arrested crawled along the path of hope on their knees, as if their legs had been amputated. Vasily Grigorievich Vlasov remembers that night after he'd been sentenced when he was being taken through dark Kadi, and four pistols were brandished on four sides of him. His main thought was, "What if they shoot right now as a provocation, claiming I was trying to escape?" Obviously he didn't yet believe in his sentence. He still hoped to live. They confined him in the police room. He was allowed to lie down on the desk to sleep, and two or three policemen kept continuous guard by the light of a kerosene lamp. They talked among themselves. "I kept listening and listening for 4 days, and I never could understand what they were being condemned for. It's not for us to understand." Vlasov lived in this room for 5 days. They were waiting for an official confirmation of the verdict in order to execute them right there in Kadi. It was not easy to convoy the condemned men to some other point. Someone sent a telegram for Vlasov requesting pardon. "I do not admit my guilt, and I request that my life be spared." There was no reply. During these days, Vlasov's hands shook, so that he could not lift his spoon to his mouth, and instead picked up his bowl and drank directly from it. Klyugin visited him to jeer. Soon after the Kadi case, he was transferred from Ivanovo to Moscow. That year saw swift ascendances and swift declines among those crimson stars of the Gulag heaven. The time was approaching when they, too, would be hurled into that same pit, but they didn't know it. Neither confirmation nor commutation of the sentence arrived, so they had to take the four condemned men to Kineshma. They took them in 4 1.5-ton trucks, with one condemned man guarded by 7 policemen in each truck. In Kineshma, they were put in the crypt of a monastery. Monastery architecture, liberated from monkish ideology, was very useful for us. At this point, some other condemned prisoners were added to their group, and they were all taken in a prisoner's railroad car to Ivanovo. In the freight yard in Ivanovo, they separated 3 from the rest, Saburov, Vlasov, and one of the men from the other group, and immediately took the others away, to be shot, so as not to crowd the prison any further. And thus it was that Vlasov said farewell to Smirnov. The 3 others were put in the courtyard of prison number 1 in the dank and raw October air, and held there for 4 hours while they led out, led in, and searched other groups of prisoners in transit. There was still no actual proof that they wouldn't be shot that very day. During those 4 hours, they had to sit there on the ground and think about it. At one point, Saburov thought they were being taken to be shot, but they were actually taken to a cell instead. He did not cry out, but he gripped his neighbor's arm so hard that the latter yelled with pain. The guards had to drag Saburov and prod him with their bayonets. There were 4 death cells in this prison, in the same corridor as the juvenile cells and the hospital cells. The death cells had 2 doors, the customary wooden door with a peephole, and a door made of iron grating. Each door had 2 locks, and the jailer and the block supervisor each had a key to a different one, so the doors could be opened only by the 2 together. Cell 43 was on the other side of a wall of the interrogator's office, and at night, while the condemned men were waiting to be executed, their ears were tormented by the screams of prisoners being tortured. Vlasov was put into cell 61. This was a cell intended for solitary confinement, 16 feet long and a little more than 3 feet wide. 2 iron cots were anchored to the floor by thick iron bolts, and on each cot 2 condemned men were lying, their heads at opposite ends. 14 other prisoners were lying crosswise on the cement floor. Though it has long been well known that even a corpse has a right to 3 arshins of earth, and even that seemed too little to check off, in this cell, each of the condemned had been allotted, while waiting for death, a little less than a third of that. Vlasov asked whether executions were carried out immediately. "See for yourself. We've been here for ages, and we're still alive." The time of waiting began, of the well-known kind. The prisoners didn't sleep all night long. In a state of total depression, they waited to be led out to death. They listened for every rustling in the corridor. And the worst thing was that endless waiting destroys the will to resist. Particularly nerve-wracking were the nights following a day on which someone received a commutation of sentence. He went off with cries of happiness, and fear thickened in the cell. After all, rejections as well as commutation had rolled down from the high mountain that day, and at night they would come for someone. Sometimes the locks rattled at night and hearts fell. "Is it for me? Not me." And the turnkey would open the wooden door for some nonsense or other. "Take your things off the windowsill." That unlocking of the door probably took a year off the lives of all 19 inmates. Maybe if that door was unlocked a mere 50 times, they wouldn't have to waste bullets. But how grateful to him everyone was, because everything was all right. "We'll take them off right away, Citizen Chief." After the morning visit to the toilet, they went to sleep, liberated from their fears. Then the jailer brought in the pail of gruel and said, "Good morning." According to prison rules, the inner iron door was supposed to be opened only in the presence of the duty officer for the prison. But as is well known, human beings are better and lazier than their rules and instructions, and in the morning the jailer came in without the duty officer and greeted them quite humanly. No, it was even more precious than that. "Good morning." To whom else on all the earth was that morning as good as it was to them? Grateful for the warmth of that voice and the warmth of that dishwater, they drifted off to sleep until noon. They ate only in the morning. Many were unable to eat when they awoke during the day. Someone had received a parcel. Relatives might or might not know about the death sentence. Once in the cell, these parcels became common property, but they lay and rotted there in the stagnant damp. By day, there was still a little life and activity in the cell. The block supervisor might come around, either gloomy Tarakanov or friendly Makarov, and offer paper on which to write petitions, and ask whether any of them who had some money wanted to buy smokes from the commissary. Their questions seemed either too outrageous or extraordinarily human. The pretense was being made that they weren't condemned men at all. Was that it? The condemned men broke off the bottoms of matchboxes, marked them like dominoes, and played away. Vlasov eased his tension by telling someone about the consumer cooperatives, and his narrative always took on a comic touch. His stories about the consumer cooperatives are remarkable and deserve to be published. Yakov Petrovich Kolpakov, the chairman of the Sudovda District Executive Committee, a Bolshevik since the spring of 1917 who joined up at the front, sat for dozens of days without changing his position, squeezing his head in his hands, his elbows on his knees, always staring at the same spot on the wall. It must have been so jolly to recall the spring of 1917. Vlasov's garrulity irritated him. "How can you?" And Vlasov snapped back at him. "And what are you doing? Preparing yourself for heaven?" Vlasov spoke with round O's, even in a fast retort. "For myself, I've decided one thing only. I'm going to tell the executioner, you alone, not the judges, not the prosecutors, you alone are guilty of my death, and you are going to have to live with it. If it weren't for you willing executioners, there would be no death sentences. So, then, let him kill me, the rat." Kolpakov was shot. Konstantin Sergeyevich Arkadyev, the former manager of the Alexandrov District Agricultural Department in Vladimir Province, was shot. Somehow, in his case, the farewells were particularly hard. During the night, six guards came tramping in for him, making a big rush of it, while he, gentle, well-mannered, kept turning around, twisting his cap in his hands, putting off the moment of his leave-taking from the last people on earth for him. And when he said his final farewell, you could hardly hear his voice. At the very first moment when the victim has been pointed out, the rest are relieved. "It's not me." But right after he has been taken away, the ones left behind are in a state that is hardly any easier to bear than his. all the next day those left behind are destined to silence, and they won't want to eat. However, Geraska, the young fellow who broke up the building of the village Soviet, ate well and slept a lot, getting used to things even here with typical peasant facility. He somehow couldn't believe they would shoot him, and they didn't. They commuted his sentence to a tenner. Several of the inmates turned grey in 3 or 4 days before their cellmates' eyes. When people wait so long for execution, their hair grows, and orders are given for the whole cell to get haircuts, for the whole cell to get baths. Prison existence goes on without regard to sentences. Some individuals lost the ability to speak intelligibly and to understand, but they were left there to await their fate anyway. Anyone who went insane in the death cell was executed insane. Many sentences were commuted. It was right then, in that fall of 1937, that 15- and 20-year terms were introduced for the first time since the revolution, and in many cases they replaced the executioner's bullets. There were also commutations to 10-year sentences, and even to 5 years. In the country of miracles, even such miracles as this were possible. Yesterday he deserved to be executed, and this morning he gets a juvenile sentence. He is a minor criminal, and in camp he may even be able to move around without convoy. V. N. Komenko, a 60-year-old Cossack captain from the Kuban, was also imprisoned in their cell. He was the soul of the cell, if a death cell can be said to have a soul. He cracked jokes. He smiled to himself. He didn't act as if things were bad. He had become unfit for military service way back after the Japanese War, had studied horse breeding, and then served in the Provincial Local Self-Government Council. By the 30s, he was attached to the Ivanovo Provincial Agricultural Department as Inspector of the Horse Herd of the Red Army. In other words, he was supposed to see to it that the best horses went to the army. He was arrested and sentenced to be shot for wrecking, for recommending that stallions be gelded before the age of 3, by which means he allegedly subverted the fighting capacity of the Red Army. Komenko appealed the verdict. 55 days later, the block supervisor came around and pointed out to him that he had addressed his appeal to the wrong appeals jurisdiction. Right then and there, propping the paper against the wall and using the block supervisor's pencil, Komenko crossed out one jurisdiction and substituted another, as if it were a request for a pack of cigarettes. Thus clumsily corrected, the appeal made the rounds for another 60 days, so Komenko had been awaiting death for 4 months. As for waiting a year or two, after all, we spend year after year waiting for the angel of death. Isn't our whole world just a death cell? And one day, complete rehabilitation for Komenko arrived. In the interval since his sentence, Voroshilov had given orders that gelding should be done before age 3. Die 1 minute and dance the next. Many sentences were commuted, and many prisoners had high hopes. But Vlasov, comparing his case with those of the others, and keeping in mind his conduct of the trial as the principal factor, felt that things were likely to go badly for him. They had to shoot someone. They probably had to shoot at least half of those condemned to death, so he came to believe they would shoot him. And he wanted just one thing, not to bow his head when it happened. That recklessness, which was one of his characteristics, returned to him and increased within him, and he was all set to be bold and brazen to the very end. And an opportunity came his way. Making the rounds of the prison for some reason, most likely just to give himself a thrill, the chief of the investigation department of Ivanovo's state security, Chunguli, ordered the door of their cell opened and stood on the threshold. He spoke to someone and asked, "Who is here from the Kadi case?" He was dressed in a short-sleeved silk shirt, which had just begun to appear in Russia and therefore still seemed effeminate. And either he or his shirt was doused in a sweetish perfume that drifted into the cell. Vlasov swiftly jumped up on the cot and shouted shrilly, "What kind of colonial officer is this? Get out of here, you murderer!" And from that height he spat juicily full into Chinguli's face. And he hit his mark. Chinguli wiped his face and retreated, because he had no right to enter the cell without 6 guards, and maybe not even with 6 guards either. A reasonable rabbit ought not to behave in that fashion. What if Chinguli had been dealing with your case at that moment and was the one to decide whether to commute or not? After all, he must have had a reason for asking, "Who is here from the Kadi case?" That was probably why he came. But there is a limit, and beyond it one is no longer willing, one finds it too repulsive, to be a reasonable little rabbit. And that is the limit beyond which rabbits are enlightened by the common understanding that all rabbits are foredoomed to become only meat and pelts, and that at best, therefore, one can gain only a postponement of death, and not life in any case. That is when one wants to shout, "Curse you! Hurry up and shoot!" It was this particular feeling of rage which took hold of Vlasov even more intensely during his 41 days of waiting for execution. In the Ivanovo prison they had twice suggested that he write a petition for pardon, but he had refused. But on the 42nd day they summoned him to a box where they informed him that the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet had commuted the supreme measure of punishment to 20 years of imprisonment in corrective labor camps, with disenfranchisement for 5 additional years. The pale Vlasov smiled wryly, and even at that point words did not fail him. "It is strange. I was condemned for lack of faith in the victory of socialism in our country. But can even Kalinin himself believe in it, if he thinks camps will still be needed in our country 20 years from now?" At the time, it seemed quite inconceivable, after 20 years. Strangely, they were still needed, even after 30. Chapter 12. Tyrzak. Oh, that good Russian word, ostrog, meaning jail. What a powerful word it is, and how well put together. One senses in it the strength of those thick, impenetrable walls from which one cannot escape. And it is all expressed in just 6 letters. And it has so many interesting connotations deriving from words that are close to it in sound. As, for instance, strogost, meaning severity, and ostrogar, meaning harpoon, and ostrotar, meaning sharpness. The sharpness of the porcupine's quills when they land in your snout. The sharpness of the blizzard lashing your frozen face. The sharpness of the pointed stakes of the camp perimeter, and the sharpness of the barbed wire, too. And the word osterojnost, meaning caution, a convict's caution, is somewhere close, too. And then the word rog, meaning horn. Yes, indeed, the horn juts out boldly and is pointed forward. It is aimed straight at us. And if one glances over all Russia's jail customs and conduct, at the entire institution during, say, the last 90 years, then you'll see not just one horn, really, but 2 horns. The Narodnaya Volya, people's will, revolutionaries, began at the tip of one horn, right where it gores, right where it's too excruciatingly painful to take, even on the breastbone. They kept wearing it down gradually until it got rounded off, shrank to a stump, and was hardly a horn any longer, and finally became just a woolly, open spot. This was the beginning of the 20th century. But then, after 1917, the first swelling of a new knob could be felt, and there, splaying out, and with the slogan, "You don't have the right," it began to thrust upward again, and to narrow to a point and harden, to acquire a horny surface, until by 1938 it was pinning the human being right in that gap between the collarbone and the neck. Tyrzak. Tyrzak equals prison confinement. Tyrzak is an official term. And once a year, the single stroke of a watchman's bell could be heard in the night in the distance. Ton. Ton equals Tyurma Osobogo Naznachenya, special purpose prison. Ton is likewise an official abbreviation. If we pursue this parabola with the help of one of the prisoners in the Schlüsselburg fortress near St. Petersburg, we find that initially things were pretty bad. The prisoner had a number, and no one called him by his family name. The gendarmes acted as if they had been trained in the Lubyanka. They didn't speak a word on their own. If you stammered out, "We," the reply came, "Speak only for yourself." The silence of the grave. The cell was in eternal shadows, the windows were frosted glass, the floor asphalt. The hinged ventilation pane in the window was open for 40 minutes a day. The food consisted of grits and cabbage soup without meat. They would not allow you any scholarly books from the library. You wouldn't see another human being for 2 years at a stretch. Only after 3 years would they let you have sheets of paper, numbered. According to the account of M. Novoruski, from 1884 to 1906, 3 prisoners in Schlüsselburg committed suicide, and 5 others went insane. And then, little by little, things got to be more lenient as the point of the horn got rounded off. There was white bread, and then the prisoners were allowed tea and sugar. One could have money and could buy things in addition to the rations. Smoking was permitted. They put transparent glass in the windows, and the transom could be kept open all the time. They painted the walls a light colour. In no time at all, you could get books by subscribing to the St. Petersburg Library. There were gratings between the garden plots. One could converse through them, and prisoners even delivered lectures to other prisoners. By then, the prisoners were urging the prison administration, "Give us more land to work on, more." So they planted 2 large prison courtyards in flowers and vegetables, no fewer than 450 varieties. And then there were scientific collections, a carpentry shop, a smithy, and they could earn money and buy books, even Russian political books, and also magazines from abroad. P.A. Krasikov, who, as we have seen, later condemned the Metropolitan Benjamin to death, read Marx's Capital in the Peter and Paul fortress. But he was there only a year, and then they let him out. And they wrote their families and got letters from them. And they could go out to walk the whole day long if they liked. And gradually, as Fichtner recollects, it was no longer the superintendent who shouted at the prisoners, but we who shouted at him. In 1902, because he refused to forward a protest of hers, she ripped the shoulder boards off his uniform. And the result was that a military investigator came and apologized profusely to Fichtner for the ignoramus superintendent. How did that horn come to shrink and broaden? Fichtner explains it to some extent by the humanitarian attitudes of individual prison superintendents, and also by the fact that the gendarmes became friendly with the prisoners, got used to them. One significant factor certainly was the prisoners' determination and dignity and adroitness in conducting themselves. But nonetheless, I myself believe that it was the temper of the times, this moisture and freshness in the air which drove away the thundercloud, this breeze of freedom which was sweeping through society. It was decisive. Without it, one could have given the gendarmes instructions from the short course every Monday, and kept tightening things up, kept putting the screws on. And instead of impressed labour, Vera Nikolaevna Fichtner, for tearing off an officer's shoulder boards, would have gotten 9 grams in the back of her head in a cellar. The weakening and shaking up of the Tsarist prison system did not come about on its own, of course, but because all society, in concert with the revolutionaries, was shaking it up and ridiculing it in every possible way. Tsarism lost its chance to survive, not in the street skirmishes of February, but several decades earlier, when youths from well-to-do families began to consider a prison term an honour, when army officers, even guard officers, began to regard it as dishonourable to shake the hand of a gendarme. And the more the prison system weakened, the more clearly evident were the triumphant ethics of the political prisoners, and the more visibly did the members of the revolutionary parties realize their strength and regard their own laws as superior to those of the state. And that was how Russia of 1917 arrived, bearing 1918 on its shoulders. The reason we have proceeded immediately to 1918 is that the subject of our investigation does not permit us to dwell on 1917. In February 1917, all political prisons, both those used for interrogation and those in which sentences were served, and all hard labour prisons as well, were emptied. It is a wonder that all the jailers managed to get through the year. Perhaps to make ends meet, they simply set to work raising potatoes in their vegetable gardens. But from 1918 on, things began to get much better for them, and at Shpalernaya prison they were still serving the new regime even in 1928, and why not? In December 1917, it had already become clear that it was altogether impossible to do without prisons, that some people simply couldn't be left anywhere except behind bars, see Chapter 2 above, because, well, simply because there was no place for them in the new society. And so it was that the new rulers managed to feel their way across the space between the two horns and grope for the budding of the second horn. Of course, they proclaimed immediately that the horrors of the Tsarist prisons would not be repeated, that fatiguing correction would not be permitted, that there would be no compulsory silence in prison, no solitary confinement, no separating the prisoners from one another during outdoor walks, no marching in step and single file, not even any locked cells. Go ahead, dear guests, get together and talk as much as you like and complain about the Bolsheviks. And the attention of the new prison authorities was directed toward the combat readiness of the prison guards outside the walls and the takeover of the stock of prisons inherited from the Tsar. This was one particular part of the machinery of state that did not have to be destroyed and rebuilt from its foundations. Fortunately, it turned out that the civil war had not resulted in the destruction of all the principal central prisons and jails. What was really necessary, however, was to repudiate all those old, besmirched words. So now they called them political isolators, political detention centres, demonstrating with this phrase their view of the members of once revolutionary parties as political enemies, and stressing not the punitive role of the bars, but only the necessity of isolating, and only temporarily, it appeared, these old-fashioned revolutionaries from the onward march of the new society. So that was how the arches of the old central prisons, evidently including the one in Suzdal from the very beginning of the Civil War, came to receive SRs, social democrats, and anarchists. They all returned to prison with a consciousness of their rights as convicts and a long-established tradition of how to stand up for them. They accepted as their legal due a special political ration, conceded by the Tsar and confirmed by the revolution, which included half a pack of cigarettes a day, purchases from the market, cottage cheese, milk, unrestricted walks outdoors during most hours of the day, being addressed with the formal personal pronoun by prison personnel and not having to stand up when addressed by them, confinement of husband and wife in the same cell, the right to have newspapers, magazines, books, writing materials, and personal articles, even including razors and scissors, sending and receiving letters 3 times a month, visits from relatives 1 a month, windows without bars, of course. At that time, the concept of the muzzle did not exist. Unrestricted visits from cell to cell, courtyards with greenery and lilacs for outdoor walks. The freedom to choose companions for outdoor walks and to toss small mail bags from one courtyard to another. And the dispatching of pregnant women from prison into exile 2 months before they were due to give birth. From 1918 on, they did not hesitate to imprison women SRs, even when they were pregnant. All this was just the Politregime, the prison regimen for political prisoners. But the political prisoners of the 20s remembered well something even more important, self-government for political prisoners, and hence, even in prison, the sense of oneself as part of a whole, a member of a community. Self-government, the free election of spokesmen who represented all the interests of all the prisoners in negotiations with the prison administration, weakened the pressure on the individual because all shoulders bore it together, and it augmented each protest because all voices spoke as one. They undertook to defend all this, and the prison authorities undertook to take it all away from them, and a silent battle began in which no artillery shells were fired, and rifle shots only rarely, and the crash of broken glass wasn't audible even half a verst away. A mute struggle went on for vestiges of freedom, for vestiges of the right to have individual opinions. And it went on for almost 20 years, but no large, richly illustrated volumes describing it have ever been published. And all its ups and downs, its catalogue of victories and of defeats, are almost lost to us now, because, after all, there is no written language in the archipelago, and oral communication is broken off when people die. And only random particles of that struggle have occasionally come down to us, illuminated by moonlight that is indirect and indistinct. And since that time we have grown so supercilious. We are familiar with tank battles. We know about nuclear explosions. What kind of struggle is it over the question of whether cells are kept locked, and whether prisoners, to exercise their right to communicate, can openly spell out messages to each other by knocking on the walls, shout from window to window, drop notes from floor to floor on threads, and insist that at least the elected spokesmen of the various party fractions be allowed to move freely among the cells? What sort of a struggle is it to us when the chief of the Lubyanka goes into the cell, and the anarchist Anna G. Blank V.A. in 1926, or the S.R. Katya Olitskaya, 1931, refuses to stand up when he enters? And that savage beast thought up a punishment for Katya, to deprive her of the right to go to the toilet. What kind of struggle was it when two girls, Shura and Vera, in 1925, in protest against the Lubyanka rule, intended to stifle personality, that conversations may be carried on only in whispers, sang loudly in their cell, only about lilacs in the spring, and thereupon the prison chief, the Latvian Dukes, dragged them through the corridor to the toilet by their hair. Or when the students in a Stolypin car en route from Leningrad, 1924, sang revolutionary songs, and the convoy thereupon deprived them of water. They yelled out, "A Tsarist convoy wouldn't have done that," and the convoy beat them. Or when the S.R. Kozlov at the transit prison in Chem loudly called the guards executioners, and because of that was dragged off and beaten. After all, we have gotten used to regarding as valour only valour in war, or the kind that's needed for flying in outer space, the kind which jingle-jangles with medals. We have forgotten another concept of valour, civil valour. And that's all our society needs, just that, just that, just that. That's all we need, and that's exactly what we haven't got. In 1923, in Vyatka prison, the S.R. Strozhinsky and his comrades, how many were there? Who were they? What were they protesting against? Barricaded themselves in a cell, poured kerosene over all the mattresses, and incinerated themselves. Now that was an act altogether in the tradition of Schlüsselburg before the revolution. And not to go further, what an uproar such an act provoked then, before the revolution, and how all Russian society was aroused. But this time around, neither Vyatka knew about them, nor Moscow, nor history. And yet, the human flesh crackled in the flames in exactly the same way. That was the initial purpose of imprisonment on the Solovetsky Islands, nicknamed Solovki. It was such a good place, cut off from communication with the outside world for half a year at a time. You couldn't be heard from there, no matter how loud you shouted, and you could even burn yourself up, for all anyone would know. In 1923, the imprisoned socialists were transported there from Pertominsk on the Onega Peninsula and split up among three isolated monasteries. Take Sabatyevsky Monastery, consisting of the two buildings which had formerly been guest quarters for religious believers on pilgrimage. Part of the lake was included in the prison compound. In the early months, everything seemed to be all right. They had their special political regimen, several relatives succeeded in getting there for visits, and three spokesmen from the three parties were wholly responsible for negotiating with the prison administration. And the monastery compound was a free zone. Inside it, the prisoners could talk, think, and do as they pleased without hindrance. But even then, at the dawn of the archipelago, there were insistent unpleasant latrine rumours, not yet so called, to the effect that the special political regimen was going to be liquidated. And, in reality, having waited until the middle of December, until the White Sea was no longer navigable, with the consequent cut-off in all communication with the outside world, the chief of the Solovetsky camp, Eichmanns, announced that new instructions had indeed been received regarding the regimen. How like Eichmann, is it not? They wouldn't, of course, take everything away, not by any means. They would cut down on correspondence and then on something else, too. And, as the most keenly felt measure of the lot, from that day on, December the 20th, 1923, the right to go in and out of prison buildings 24 hours a day would be curtailed, limited to the daylight hours up to 6 p.m. The party factions decided to protest, and the SRs and anarchists called for volunteers. On the first day of the new prohibition, they would go outside exactly at 6 p.m. But, as it turned out, Nogtyev, the chief of the Savatyevsky Monastery prison, had such an itchy trigger finger that even before the appointed hour of 6, and maybe their watches showed different times, after all there was no checking it by radio in those days, the guards entered the compound with rifles and opened fire on the prisoners there who were out of doors quite legally. 3 volleys killed 6 and critically wounded 3. The next day, Eichmann's himself showed up. There had been an unfortunate misunderstanding. Nogtyev was removed, transferred and promoted. A funeral was held for the victims. They sang in chorus across the Solovetsky wilderness, "You fell a victim in a fateful fray." Was not this perhaps the last occasion when that long, drawn-out melody was permitted for newly dead victims? They pushed a great boulder onto the common grave and carved on it the names of those who had been killed. In 1925, the stone was overturned, and the names on it were thus buried too. Any of you who clamber about Solovki, seek it out and gaze upon it. One cannot say that the press concealed this event. Pravda, for example, carried a report in small type. The prisoners had attacked the convoy, and 6 had been killed. The honest newspaper Rotepana reported revolt on Solovki. One of the SRs in the Savatyevsky Monastery was Yuri Podbelsky. He collected the medical documents on the Solovetsky massacre for publication at some future date. But a year later, at the Sverdlovsk transit prison, they discovered a false bottom in his suitcase and confiscated the material he'd hidden. And that is how Russian history stumbles and falls. Yet the prisoners had defended the regiment successfully, and for a whole year no one spoke of changing it. For the whole of 1924, yes. But toward the end of the year, insistent rumors circulated again that they were planning to introduce a new system in December. The dragon had grown hungry again. He wanted new victims. So even though the 3 monasteries in which socialists were confined, Savatyevsky, Troitsky, and Muksalmsky, were on separate islands, they managed by conspiratorial methods to reach an agreement that all the party fractions in all 3 monasteries would on one and the same day deliver an ultimatum to Moscow and to the Solovki administration. They must either be removed from the Solovetsky Islands before navigation stopped, or else the previous political regimen must be left unchanged. The ultimatum stipulated a time limit of 2 weeks, and then all 3 prisons would go on a hunger strike. This kind of unity compelled attention. It wasn't the sort of thing you could allow to go in one ear and out the other. One day before the time limit expired, Eichmann's visited each monastery and announced that Moscow had refused. And on the appointed day, a hunger strike began. Not a dry hunger strike. Water was allowed. In all 3 monastery prisons, which were now able to communicate with each other. In Savatyevsky, about 200 people struck. Those who fell ill were exempted from striking. A doctor from among the prisoners examined the strikers every day. A collective hunger strike is always more difficult to carry out than an individual one. After all, the weakest, rather than the strongest of the strikers, can determine its outcome. The only point to a hunger strike is to carry it out with implacable determination and in such a way that everyone knows everyone else involved personally and trusts them fully. Given various party fractions, given several hundred people, both disagreements and moral anguish on other people's behalf were inevitable. After 15 days, it was necessary to vote by secret ballot in Savatyevsky. The urn with the ballots was taken from room to room, whether to continue or to lift the hunger strike. And Moscow and Eichmann's waited them out. After all, they were well-fed, and there wasn't a peep from the capital newspapers about the hunger strike, and there were no student protest meetings at Kazan Cathedral. Silence was already confidently shaping our history. The monasteries lifted the hunger strike. They had not won out, but they hadn't lost either. The political regimen was left intact for the winter, except that cutting firewood in the forests was added, but that was logical enough. And in the spring of 1925, it looked as though the hunger strike had brought victory. The prisoners from all three monastery prisons were removed from Solovki to the mainland. No more Arctic night, and no more half-year cut off from communication. But both the convoy and their rations en route were very harsh for that time, and soon they were all perfidiously tricked, on the pretext that their spokesman would be more comfortable in the staff car with the stores and equipment. They were deprived of their leaders. The staff car was detached at Vyatka, and the spokesmen were taken to the Tobolsk isolator. Only at that point did it become clear that the hunger strike of the previous fall had failed. The strong and influential spokesmen had been taken away so as to tighten up on the rest. Yagoda and Katanyan personally directed the incarceration of the former Solovetsky Islands prisoners in the long-standing but until then unused buildings of the Verkhno-Uralsk isolator, which they thus opened in the spring of 1925, under Chief Duper. It was destined to be a particular bugbear to prisoners for many decades ahead. The relocated former Solovki prisoners immediately lost their freedom to move about. The cells were locked. They succeeded in electing spokesmen, nonetheless, but the spokesmen didn't have the right to go from cell to cell. The unlimited circulation between cells of money, personal articles, and books, which had existed earlier, was now forbidden. They shouted back and forth from window to window until the guard fired from his tower into the cells. In reply, they organized a protest. They broke window panes and destroyed prison equipment. And after all, breaking a window pane is something to think about twice. They might just not replace it all window, and there would be no big surprise in that. It was under the Tsar that the glaziers used to come on the run. The struggle continued, but it was now being carried on in desperation and under grave handicaps. In the year 1928, according to Pyotr Petrovich Rubin, some event or other precipitated a new joint hunger strike by the entire Verkhno-Uralsk isolator. But this time, the earlier stern and solemn atmosphere was absent, as were the approval of friends and a doctor of their own. On a certain day of the strike, the jailers came bursting into the cells in overwhelming numbers and simply began to beat the weakened prisoners with clubs and boots. They beat them to within an inch of their lives, and the hunger strike ended. From our experience of the past and our literature of the past, we have derived a naive faith in the power of a hunger strike. But the hunger strike is a purely moral weapon. It presupposes that the jailer has not entirely lost his conscience, or that the jailer is afraid of public opinion. Only in such circumstances can it be effective. The Tsarist jailers were still inexperienced. They got nervous if one of their prisoners went on a hunger strike. They exclaimed over it. They looked after him. They put him in the hospital. There are many examples, but this work is not about them. It is even humorous to note that it was enough for Valentinov to go on a hunger strike for 12 days. As a result, he not only achieved some relaxation in the regimen, but was totally released from interrogation, whereupon he went to Lenin in Switzerland. Even in the Orel Central Hard Labor Prison, the strikers always won. They got the regimen relaxed in 1912 and further relaxed in 1913, to the point of general access to outdoor walks for all political hard labor prisoners, who were obviously so unrestricted by their supervisors that they managed to compose and send out to freedom their appeal to the Russian people. And this from the hard labor prisoners of a central prison. Furthermore, it was published. It's enough to make one's eyes pop out of one's head. Someone has to have been crazy. It was published in 1914 in issue number 1 of the Vestny Katorgi I Silki, the Hard Labor and Exile Herald. M.N. Gernet, Historia Tsarkoi Tyrmy, A History of Tsarist Prisons, Moscow, Yuridicheskaya Literatura, Legal Literature Publishers, 1960-1963, Volume 5, Chapter 8. And what about that herald itself? Should we, too, perhaps try to publish one like it? In 1914, after only 5 days of a hunger strike, admittedly without water, Dzerzhinsky and 4 of his comrades obtained all their numerous demands, which had to do with living conditions. In those years, there were no dangers or difficulties for the prisoner beyond the torments of hunger. They could not beat him up for going on a hunger strike, nor sentence him to a second term, nor increase his term, nor shoot him, nor send him off on a prisoner transport. All this was to come later on. In the revolution of 1905 and the years following it, the prisoners felt themselves to be masters of the prison to such an extent that they did not even go to the trouble of declaring a hunger strike. They simply destroyed prison property, so-called obstructions, or went so far as to declare a strike, although it might seem that for prisoners this would have hardly any meaning. Thus, in the city of Nikolaev in 1906, 197 prisoners in the local prison declared a strike in conjunction with people outside. Outside the prison, leaflets in support of their strike were published, and daily meetings assembled in front of the prison. These meetings, and it goes without saying that the prisoners were at the windows, which had, of course, no muzzles, forced the administration to accept the demands of the striking prisoners. After this, some people on the street and others behind the bars joined in singing revolutionary songs. And things went on that way for 8 days. And nobody stopped them. It was, after all, a year of post-revolutionary repression. On the 9th day, all the demands of the prisoners were satisfied. Similar incidents occurred at the time in Odessa, in Kherson, and in Yeliznovetgrad. That's how easily victory was attained then. It would be interesting, incidentally, to compare the effectiveness of hunger strikes under the provisional government with those few Bolsheviks imprisoned from the July days until the Kornilov episode. Kamenev, Trotsky, and Raskolnikov for a while longer, evidently had no reason to go on a hunger strike. In the 20s, the lively picture of hunger strikes grows clouded, though that depends, of course, on the point of view. This widely known weapon, which had justified itself so gloriously, was, of course, taken over not only by recognized politicals, but also by those who were not recognized as such, the KRs, Article 58, counter-revolutionaries, and all other kinds of riffraff. However, those arrows which used to be so piercing had been blunted somehow, or else some iron hand had checked them in mid-flight. True, written declarations of impending hunger strikes were still accepted, and nothing subversive was seen in them as yet. But unpleasant new rules were trotted out. The hunger striker had to be isolated in a special solitary cell. In the Butyrki, it was in the Pugachev Tower. It was essential to keep any knowledge about the hunger strike not only from people outside, who might protest publicly, and from prisoners in cells nearby, but even from those in the cell in which the hunger striker had been imprisoned until that day, for that, too, constituted a public, and it was necessary to separate him from it. This measure had as its nominal justification the argument that the prison administration had to make sure that the hunger strike was going on honestly, that others in the cell weren't sneaking food to the hunger striker. And how had that been verified previously? Through honest, cross-my-heart word of honour? Still, it was possible in those years to achieve at least one's personal demands by this means. From the 30s on, state thinking about hunger strikes took a new turn. What did the state want with even such watered-down, isolated, half-suppressed hunger strikes? Wasn't the ideal picture one of prisoners who had no will of their own, nor the capacity to make their own decisions, and of a prison administration that did their thinking and their deciding for them? These are, if you will, the only prisoners who can exist in the new society. And so, from the beginning of the 30s, they stopped accepting declarations of hunger strikes as legal. "The hunger strike, as a method of resistance, no longer exists," they proclaimed to Yekaterina Olitskaya in 1932, and they said the same thing to many others. "The government has abolished your hunger strikes, and that's that." But Olitskaya refused to obey and began to fast. They let her go on fasting in solitary for 15 days. Then they took her to the hospital and put milk and dried crusts in front of her to tempt her. But she stood firm, and on the 19th day she won her victory. She got an extended outdoor period and newspapers and parcels from the political Red Cross. That's how one had to moan and groan in order to receive those legitimate relief parcels. Overall, however, it was an insignificant victory and paid for too dearly. Olitskaya recalled such foolish hunger strikes on the part of others, too. People starved up to 20 days in order to get delivery of a parcel or a change of companions for their outdoor walk. Was it worth it? After all, in the new type prison, one's strength, once lost, could not be restored. The religious sect member Koloskov fasted until he died on the 25th day. Could one in general permit oneself to fast in the new type prison? After all, the new prison heads, operating in secrecy and silence, had acquired several powerful methods of combating hunger strikes. One, patience on the part of the administration. We have seen enough of what this meant from preceding examples. Two, deception. This, too, can be practiced thanks to total secrecy. When every step is reported by the newspapers, you aren't going to do much deceiving. But in our country, why not? In 1933, in the Khabarovsk prison, S.A. Chebotaryev, demanding that his family be informed of his whereabouts, fasted for 17 days. He had come from the Chinese Eastern Railroad in Manchuria and then suddenly disappeared, and he was worried about what his wife might be thinking. On the 17th day, Zapadny, the deputy chief of the provincial GPU, and the Khabarovsk province prosecutor, their ranks indicate that lengthy hunger strikes were really not so frequent, came to see him and showed him a telegraph receipt. There, they said, they had informed his wife, and thus persuaded him to take some broth. And the receipt was a fake. Why had these high-ranking officials gone to this trouble? Not certainly for Chebotaryev's life. Evidently in the first half of the 30s, there was still some sort of personal responsibility on the part of higher-ups for long, drawn-out hunger strikes. 3. Forced artificial feeding. This method was adapted, without any question, from experience with wild animals in captivity, and it could be employed only in total secrecy. By 1937, artificial feeding was, evidently, already in wide use. For example, in the group hunger strike of socialists in the Yaroslavl Central Prison, artificial feeding was forced on everyone on the 15th day. Artificial feeding has much in common with rape, and that's what it really is. Four big men hurl themselves on one weak being and deprive it of its one interdiction. They only need to do it once, and what happens to it next is not important. The element of rape inheres in the violation of the victim's will. It's not going to be the way you want it, but the way I want it. Lie down and submit. They pry open the mouth with a flat disc, then broaden the crack between the jaws and insert a tube. Swallow it. And if you don't swallow it, they shove it farther down anyway, and then pour liquefied food right down the esophagus. And then they massage the stomach to prevent the prisoner from resorting to vomiting. The sensation is one of being morally defiled, of sweetness in the mouth, and a jubilant stomach gratified to the point of delight. Science did not stand still, and other methods were developed for artificial feeding. An enema through the anus, drops through the nose. 4. A new view of the hunger strike. That hunger strikes are a continuation of counter-revolutionary activity in prison, and must be punished with a new prison term. This aspect promised to give rise to a very rich new category in the practices of the new type prison, but it remained essentially in the realm of threats. And it was not, of course, any sense of humour that cut it short, but most likely simple laziness. Why bother with all that when patience will take care of it? Patience and more patience, the patience of a well-fed person vis-à-vis one who is starving. Approximately in the middle of 1937, a new directive came. From now on, the prison administration will not in any respect be responsible for those dying on hunger strikes. The last vestige of personal responsibility on the part of the jailers had disappeared. In these circumstances, the prosecutor of the province would not have come to visit Chebotaryev. Furthermore, so that the interrogator shouldn't get disturbed, it was also announced that days spent on hunger strike by a prisoner under interrogation should be crossed off the official interrogation period. In other words, it should not only be considered that the hunger strike had not taken place, but the prisoner should be regarded as not having been in prison at all during the period of the strike. Thus, the interrogator would not be to blame for being behind schedule. Let the only perceptible result of the hunger strike be the prisoner's exhaustion. And that meant, if you want to kick the bucket, go ahead. Arnold Rappaport had the misfortune to declare a hunger strike in the Archangel NKVD internal prison at the very moment when this directive arrived. It was a particularly severe form of hunger strike, and that ought, it would seem, to have given it more impact. His was a dry strike, without fluids, and he kept it up for 13 days. Compare the 5-day dry strike of Dzerzhinsky, who probably wasn't isolated in a separate cell, and who in the end won total victory. And during those 13 days in solitary, to which Rappaport had been moved,